Welcome. My name is Patrick Curran, and along with my soon-to-be self-pardoned co-host Greg Hancock, we make up Quantitude. We are a podcast dedicated to all things quantitative, ranging from the relevant to the completely irrelevant. In this episode, we compare and contrast multiple regression and the structural equation model, and argue that although regression has brought us far, there are numerous reasons to turn to the SEM to continue to drive us forward. Along the way, we also address gadflies, the Louisiana Purchase, Kool-Aid, high school friends, spring break, STDs, Southwest Airlines, radial arm saws, courage, buying paint at Home Depot, Agatha and Carl's corpses, and 737s versus DC-3s. We hope you enjoy today's episode. You know who David Friedman is?
I do.
Have you met him?
No, but I've read some very sharp things that he wrote.
So, in other words, you read some things that he wrote.
Right.
David Friedman's a statistician, was a statistician. He passed away a few years ago. Insanely smart, spent his entire career at Berkeley, really developed into almost a philosopher of science. And he, I think, is almost a self-proclaimed gadfly in statistical literature, being the one who's going to raise the uncomfortable questions and push us back into the middle of the playing field. Why raise it? I did my postdoc. It was before the Louisiana Purchase. I think it was just, that was just when it was wrapping up. And I was at UCLA, and I had the honor of getting to know Peter Bentler. And he is at UCLA in psychology, and he is one of my heroes in the field and was incredibly kind and supportive to me, both then and for decades after. He came over and he said, hey, there's this guy giving a talk, David Friedman. Do you want to go over with me? And so he and I walked over and sat down. I had no idea who this was. I didn't know his background. I didn't know his stature. He was just a guy. And oh my God, he just excoriated structural equation modeling. And he put up these path diagrams on his transparency, because remember, transparencies existed before the Louisiana Purchase. They were ridiculous path models that he had found in the literature. No reasonable person would defend these. He was really engaging, really entertaining, but oh my God, he was just scorching model after model that he put up. And then he made this very hyperbolic statement about we had to outlaw structural equation models. That was the final point of his talk. We had to outlaw SEMs. And there's this kind of shocked silence. Now, keep in mind, I didn't know who he was. I didn't know any of the background. I didn't know anything at all, but I raised my hand. And in this childlike, naive way, I said, so do we outlaw the t-test too? Do we outlaw ANOVA? Do we outlaw regression? And he said, no, of course not. No, we don't. It's back to basics. One of his big things was, we make things too complicated intentionally, and we need to go back to graphics, and we need to go back to simpler comparisons. And again, I was like a six-year-old, and I didn't get it. I wasn't being adversarial. I wasn't fighting him. There was this pause, and I was like, but the t-test is an SEM. And I hear this snort, and I look over, and Peter has his head kind of down with his hands kind of pinching his nose, and he's trying not to laugh. And now I'm doubly confused because I have a real question. And he goes on to this diatribe, and he pretty much takes me to task. I mean, he's kind of attacking me on these different things. And I have never been so confused in my life. It was an honest, legit question. And it wasn't until we were walking back that Peter said, yeah, you kind of walked into something there. And it made me, one, smile in just a fond reminiscence of Peter being an incredibly supportive senior person in the field with me. But the other one of just thinking about this broader issue of how are simpler models nested within more complicated models, and what do those more complicated frameworks give us that the simpler models may not? And not only where are they equivalent, but more importantly, where are they not equivalent?
I love that story. That makes me think of a line that you used before. What exactly is your point?
Wow.
Sorry, I've been waiting. I've been waiting to use that.
I thought we understood that I could ask you that, but that you were not necessarily going to ask me that.
Oh, okay.
You got to read the policy manual again. My point is, you had texted me a couple of days ago about a Twitter thread related to regression SEM, and it made me think about that.
Yeah. I was having a really nice thread about regression versus structural equation modeling, and do we really need structural equation modeling versus regression? Isn't regression adequate for the things that we're going to do? And I thought it might be a really nice opportunity for us to talk about what some of the benefits are of regression, but also maybe some of the limitations and work toward the broader SEM framework. What do you think?
Yes.
Get us started with regression. Get our regression juices flowing here.
I love regression. It's almost magic. Mm-hmm. I think that the elegance of it, the equations that underlie it, which you can actually understand because there are other equations that underlie things that I can typeset and I can put on a PowerPoint slide and I can talk about, but I don't see it, you know, where like you see inside is regression. It's almost like the Matrix, where he finally melds with the Matrix and you see the numbers coming down.
He is the one.
And so we have a continuous dependent variable. We established last week that we don't, for the ordinary least squares part of the estimation, require that to be normally distributed. We need to assume normality of the residuals to get our standard errors and mean squared error and test statistic. Mm-hmm. But we have a continuous dependent variable, and we are trying to map that onto a set of predictors. One of my favorite descriptors of models like these are we're trying to find the optimal linear combination of our predictors and how that relates to the dependent variable. So good old Gauss Markov told us that we have to make certain assumptions. We assume that those distributions are fixed and known, which means although the dependent variable has to be continuous, the predictors are like variables on spring break. Man, load up the minivan, go to Fort Lauderdale, take your top off. You can be binary. You can be a count. You can be a 1 degree of freedom chi-square. It's like, dude, what happens in Fort Lauderdale stays in Fort Lauderdale. This is one of the misunderstandings sometimes about the regression model is we make a very strong assumption about the continuity of the dependent variable, but go nuts on the IV side. You can do anything you want. Mm-hmm. And so then what we want to do, and this is part of the magic element of it, is we have some observed value Y, which is our dependent variable, and we take this optimal linear combination of our set of predictors and get a model implied value or a predicted value, and it's our Y hat. And the whole goal is to minimize the difference between Y, which we observed, and Y hat that we predicted. To do that, we're going to pick our values of our regression coefficients that minimizes the sum of the squared residuals. So we take Y minus Y hat to get a residual. We square it. We add them up. Mm-hmm. And then we pick our values for our regression coefficients that makes that sum of squared residuals as small as mathematically possible. So you get an optimal linear combination of your set of predictors, and you get two amazing things. One is you get a joint test that says when you take your set of predictors simultaneously, what is the proportion of variance that's explained in your dependent variable? That's R squared. So you get an R squared of 0.22, and you say the optimal linear combination of our set of predictors accounts for approximately 22% of the variance that was observed in the dependent variable. But then we get a unique estimate, a partial estimate, and it's each predictor above and beyond the others. So we had an episode earlier on control variables, and we delved into the fascinating field of drag racing.
Sunday at Smokin' US 30 drag strip.
Watch the best rear engine field dragsters in the country.
And we talked about statistical control. Well, it is, what is the influence of each predictor controlling for the others? So we get unique estimates. And then we dig up Agatha Christie and bring her in, light her a cigarette, give her a nice cup of tea, and say, here's our set of predictors, here's each unique predictor, go ahead and tell us a story about how our predictors are related to the outcome. And it is elegant, and it is tough as nails. Mm-hmm. You can back over the regression model with a truck, and it hangs in there for the most part, and I love it.
Wow, that was a nice review of it, especially some of the underpinnings of it. Let me ask you this. What would you say are some of your favorite research questions, or the structure of some of your favorite research questions that you think regression model is best suited for?
None.
It is magic, but it can't do crap.
I'm sorry, was I not clear when I said none?
Multiple regression has been, for generations, this workhorse where so many research questions are either conformed to fit within a regression model, or the regression model is just limiting the scope of the questions that people are addressing. Sometimes people will be doing questions about the extent to which certain variables are predictive of a particular outcome. Sometimes people will think about it from a more explanatory mechanism, but I consider it to be an incredibly limited framework. And you just went directly to the none. It's useful for none. I like that. Can you tell us, Dr. Curran, why you think it's useful for basically nothing in a motivating, uplifting way?
Yeah, I can't.
No.
Can answer the question, but I'm neither going to be motivating nor uplifting.
Come on, use your New Year's resolutions.
That's a grievance for next year. I despise New Year's resolution. So what do I not like about regression?
Yeah.
The lack of control. We've established that both you and I have certain control issues. And our spouses would replace certain with extreme and irrational. I have never piloted a plane in my life, but I really feel the need to tell the Southwest pilot that he needs to extend his flaps now. What I don't like is regression is a bit of a horse race. As a researcher, we identify what the dependent variable is, and we identify what the independent variables are. We have some control over saying, well, I believe these two variables interact with one another, or I believe this predictor may have a curvilinear effect on the outcome. We've got a couple of little things. It's kind of like asking your kid, do you want to take a bath before dinner or take a bath after dinner? It's completely up to you. Once we've picked our predictors and once we've picked our dependent variables, you're done, right? And what I mean is we don't impose any constraints on that model. We don't impose any restriction. All the independent variables co-vary with one another. All the independent variables predict the dependent variable. There are no degrees of freedom. There are no restrictions, and there are no a priori testable hypotheses where we impose a restriction on the parameter space and evaluate the adequacy of that with respect to the empirical data. What bothers me is you're dealt your hand in terms of how the IVs are related to the DV and a whole variety of other things so that OLS works in the way that we want it to. I don't think you are in control of the ship. You're kind of along for the ride. That optimal linear combination, right? If you do it in matrix form, you have a design matrix X that has your predictors. You have a vector Y that is your dependent variable. X prime X inverse X prime Y. It's a single closed form matrix expression, and you get your vector of regression coefficients and you're done. Mm-hmm. And what I do is lean back and say, but that's not the model I want. And regression often says, sorry, buddy, you dance with who brought you.
So I can think of some research questions that fit okay within the general linear model.
Bah.
Was that your Agatha Christie?
She wants another Marlboro. She doesn't have a lower jaw, and so she goes, ah, and that means she wants another cigarette.
So there are some questions that I think fit into the general linear model, that fit into the regression framework kind of nicely. And, you know, when we're teaching people about a lot of research methods, we often frame it in terms of trying to understand the relation between some independent variable and some dependent variable. And this seems ideally suited. So if someone says, I would like to know the impact of a treatment where the treatment variable is defined as a binary variable, treatment and control groups, I would like to know the impact of treatment on a particular outcome. Right? It might be some psychological outcome from your world. And I might like to do that while controlling for a number of other variables. This framework seems perfect for that, but you don't like it that much.
Okay. I totally see that. You have a treatment and control, a dependent variable. Mm-hmm. You have a couple of covariates. That's old school ANCOVA. I hope your dependent variable has a normally distributed residual. I hope that you don't have any interests in mediators.
Mm-hmm.
Golly, I hope your covariates are measured with perfect reliability, because if not, you're going to get bias in your parameter estimates. What I might argue is, why not embed that within the broader SEM? And if you meet those OLS kinds of assumptions and restrictions, great.
Mm-hmm.
It simplifies down to the GLM. But in the likely situation that you do not meet those, well, then you can do something about it in a way that you can't in the general linear model.
You and I both drank the Kool-Aid. There's no question, right? So we know how we are going to land on this particular issue, but I'd like to help people see why we're going in that particular direction. And it's more than just the fact that regression can be viewed as a special case of some larger system. You don't always need a larger system. You don't need a giant radial arm saw to cut a toothpick, for example.
But it's pretty damn cool if you do.
Oh my God, it's so cool. So let me think about the limitations of regression in a variety of ways. First of all, people will use it as a predictive system. I might argue that it's not such a great model for predictive things. We have made improvements over the last 80 to 100 years on that model when it comes to prediction. A lot of advances in the last 20 to 25 years as our computational horsepower has increased. It is a linear predictive model, and that has some strengths, I suppose, but we can probably do a lot better in the predictive world. So I will say, from a predictive standpoint, it's not the best that's out there. From an explanatory standpoint, and this is really where I would like to go, I think it's incredibly limited. Let's imagine that this model actually is the model that you're looking for, that I have four predictors and I have a Y variable. Imagine someone has a research question like, I wonder if X1 is a stronger predictor than X2. Well, that's not something that's easily addressed within this particular framework, and it's often relegated to an eyeball test. Now, there are ways that people have come up with for trying to make comparisons within a particular model, but it's not something that regression naturally lends itself to. What if somebody believes that a couple of the predictors have no theoretical reason to correlate with each other? Well, what do you do? And the answer is, not a damn thing, because as you said, you get what you get, right? You hand it over to regression. It is a model that you just have no control over. At the end of the day, one of the biggest limitations of the regression model is that you have almost no control over things. You decide what predictors go in, and after that, you just press run, and you get what you get. Imagine that you do have a model with mediation. Let's set our way back machine to 1973. What are you going to do to test mediation with your shiny regression kit? What would you do?
In 73, I was 8, mm-hmm. so probably not a lot. And I was not the sharpest pencil in the box. And so if you asked me that in 73, I wouldn't be terribly much use.
We need some 70s music.
So if you're going to go all the way back to 73, I'm not going to do anything, because I don't think people are really even talking about that. I don't know historically when people really started talking about mediation. It wasn't mm-hmm. until the earlier mid-80s that people started taking it seriously. And mm-hmm. Barron and Kenny in 86 laid out mm-hmm. quit confusing mediation and moderation, and here's how you do each. But if you're really going to go back to 73, I'd say nothing at all.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Maybe somebody would say, well, if we had one predictor in and it was significant and we brought another predictor in and that first one became non-significant,
right,
that might imply some mediating mechanism. But I don't know historically when people started taking tests of that seriously.
It was very clumsy, right? At best, what you're doing is you are splicing together results from a series of multiple regressions to try to make an inference about some larger system. Once you have a belief about a world where there are multiple things functioning as dependent variables, the only way to approach that with regression is to think about it in pieces. There are some small arguments here and there about benefits that might occur from looking at things in pieces. But overall, if you're trying to understand a system, it's awfully clumsy to try to look at it in these little bits.
Going back to what you said about how we drank the Kool-Aid on it, we definitely did. But I feel like in the same way that I drank the Kool-Aid on penicillin, seatbelts, nutrition.
Speed limits. Not that Kool-Aid.
I love where there's a larger system that with restrictions will give you our good old friends from high school, right? Mm-hmm. It's not that I'm saying that we shouldn't ever consider a regression-like framework for a particular question and a particular set of measures taken on a particular sample. But what I am saying is, if that's your model, we can define it as such within the SEM framework. And they are one and the same. They are not kind of similar. You mm-hmm. wouldn't draw the same conclusions, more or less. They are the same damn thing. So my belief is, why not start with the more general framework? And mm-hmm. if you end up back with your best friend from high school, the regression model, then great. There's no reason to over-engineer a solution to a problem that doesn't exist. Mm-hmm. But why not pick those covariances? Pick those regression coefficients. Pick the method of estimation that optimally corresponds to the distribution of your dependent variable and the residual distribution of that dependent variable. And if that ends up OLS, hey, that's awesome. Good for you. But it may not. And I would argue it likely does not. It's not dissimilar to when I teach about factor analysis and rotation. I never see a motivation to do an orthogonal rotation. Because you are forcing orthogonality on your latent factors. I would far rather see an oblique rotation. And if it turns out the factors are uncorrelated, then they will resolve to zero correlations among the latent factors. You've allowed it as part of your model, and those are the optimal values that are taken by the sample data. But when you force the orthogonality on, it's not a testable hypothesis. You're making it that way. And I just see it very similar. If that is ultimately your structure that you want to use for a test of your hypothesis, do it within the SEM because at least you're making the decision. You're reaching into the system and the designing it in the way that you want, and you're not being handed that ticket from the OLS ticket machine.
Right now, it seems like you are in some ways approaching it from a statistical perspective, that the statistical machinery from structural equation modeling resolves to your old high school buddy regression under certain circumstances. I would like to complement that with research questions also might resolve to that particular model, but you have so much more control. And that's the point that you were making. And as we've said many times, we both have those control issues. Within a structural equation modeling framework, you can do tests of individual parameters, which might look like regression coefficients. You can compare them. You can turn parameters off. You could ask a bizarre question like, does this variable have twice the effect of something else? Why would you want to address that? I don't know, but you have the flexibility to do things like that. In regression, you got nothing. Variables covary the way they do. Variables relate to Y the way they do. Zero control to do anything that's even remotely interesting, like mediation. If you have some broader system, you and I talk about longitudinal models in our regular lives all the time, right? We care about those kinds of things. To what extent do things at time one have a bearing on things at time two and time three and time four and time five? I don't even know how you band-aid together regressions to start unpacking that properly.
To me, it goes back to the whiteboard problem. So you talked about having your Sharpie that can't be erased, and you walk up to the whiteboard, and you draw rectangles that indicate your measured variables.
Yeah.
But you don't do anything to link them yet. You just draw your variables. So everybody who's listening, isn't it helpful that differentiate from those who's not listening?
Uh-huh.
It was like the other day I said, well, I was talking to my dad before he died. My brother was like, thanks for clarifying that.
Uh-huh.
So to those of you who are listening, think of your own variables. Think of what you have measured in your data set. Go up to your whiteboard and draw them out. Now, don't link them together yet. Just draw them out. Now, imagine you're going to do a regression. Your one requirement is to click on the dependent variable. Of all the variables that are on the board, you're going to click on the dependent variable. If you're doing regression, all the arrows are going to populate automatically. All the one-headed arrows, all the two-headed arrows, the disturbance, it's all going to populate automatically because once you click on the dependent variable, everything else is established for you. X prime X inverse X prime Y. If I could get that on my license plate, I would. Instead, you walk up to the board and say, here's how I believe the variables to be related to one another. Here's where I believe the double-headed arrows exist, the single-headed arrows exist, the residual variances. You may step back and say, huh, that's a regression model. But I don't think you will. I think more often than not, you're going to end up with something that is not within the confines of the regression. So you can either cut things in half and bolt them back together in trying to do this piecewise series of regressions to kind of do what you want, or you can just say, I don't have to be limited by that clicking the dependent variable. I can write in anything I want. And that then puts you within the SEM.
You and I are so accustomed to thinking about things in terms of the whiteboard, in terms of the boxes and the arrows. And some of the people who operate largely within a regression framework might not even think about the world in that way. So what I might say, just to elaborate on some of the things that you said, the way regression people look at a regression model might even be in terms of an equation. Even though I understand the equations, I tend to think about a regression model just as you describe in terms of boxes and arrows and all of that. And the boxes and arrows that we are talking about, I would like people to visualize this. For those people who are dyed-in-the-wool regression people, you have one box that has a Y on it. You have a whole bunch of other boxes that have X's on them, X1, X2, X3. And when Patrick says you click on the Y variable and then, boop, regression just does everything, the arrows are that each of the X's now has an arrow coming directly into Y, meaning potentially that it has an impact if you have some causal belief, or at least it has some predictive value in understanding Y, and that all of the X's are connected by two-headed arrows, meaning that they are allowed to covary. You don't have any say in this matter. You can't turn off an X. You can't say that these two predictors have no reason to be connected with each other from a theoretical standpoint. You get what you get. And I love your point that if you stand back and look at that board and draw all of the arrows in and go, huh, that looks familiar, that's regression, then it's great. But your final take-home point is, when is that actually going to happen?
To layer on top of that, I'll go out in the backyard and dig up Karl Popper. I have a very interesting backyard.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah. He's getting high with John Stuart Mill. Those two, you can't leave them alone.
The crazy kids.
That was my skull. I'm so wasted.
So I'm going to drag in by the left foot Karl Popper and prop him up next to Agatha. And Popper, if I were to channel for his corpse, would say, yes, that regression model is elegant. Tell me, Patrick, where is the restriction you're putting on that makes it a testable hypothesis? Where is strong falsification? Where are you putting your theories at dire risk on a daily basis? And I'd say, shut up, Karl, you're dead. He is spot on, which is the other thing that I deeply don't like about regression is every regression model ever estimated and that ever will be estimated is just identified. We are estimating as many parameters in the model as pieces of information that we observed. We are imposing no restrictions. We are allowing ourselves no a priori testable hypotheses. And that, I think, is truly one of the biggest limitations of the regression model. Part of it is just that, that we are not saying, I believe parental alcoholism impacts stress, which impacts negative affect, and does not go through anxiety. I'm going to remove that regression parameter and test the veracity of that from an inferential framework based on the empirical data that I have. It is an a priori testable hypothesis. I am putting my theory in dire risk by removing that and seeing what the implications are. But on top of that, the regression model has the patina of model testing because you have an F test and a P value and an R squared. That must be testing model fit. Well, it's not because the model fits perfectly. What that F test is evaluating the relative magnitude of the R squared, which is not a test of model fit. That's my second problem, is I feel like it seems like we're testing a model in a regression, but I would argue that we are not.
That's a confusing point for folks because there is a test. You feel like, oh, I tested my regression model. All you did was test whether or not there was a non-zero amount of variance explained in your outcome variable. That's not really the same as testing whether or not this is a reasonable explanatory mechanism for what's going on. If your regression model is meant to symbolize a particular process, just testing the amount of variance that is explained in your outcome is not the same as testing whether or not the system that you have articulated captures the processes that are going on. And yes, you do get individual tests associated with each predictor, but as you said, we're never putting this model in danger. This model can't fail, and you describe it as just identified. That means that throw any data at it, this model will still fit and fit perfectly. Now, that sounds counterintuitive to some folks, because if you have a really low R squared, you might say, well, how does it fit perfectly? I have a really low R squared. And the answer is, it explains all the variance that it can possibly explain. It explains all the relations that variables have. If you have a low relation between your X's and Y, then guess what? Your model is going to give you something that is appropriately low. I love that you brought up Karl Popper. Not as much that you have him buried in your backyard. You have this whole field of bodies in your backyard.
It's a hobby.
Traveling on so many levels. But I like that you brought up Popper and the issue of falsifiability. Can you help us connect the dots in terms of how moving into a structural equation modeling framework, or at least what we might call a classic path analysis kind of framework, helps us to introduce falsifiability and the value of that?
It all centers around courage and how courage relates to degrees of freedom.
Uh-huh.
So if you define a regression model within the SEM, it has no degrees of freedom. Each degree of freedom represents a restriction that we're imposing on our parameter space. If you remove a parameter, you get one degree of freedom. Mm-hmm. If you set two parameters to be equal to one another, you get one degree of freedom. It's a restriction on the parameter space. Those degrees of freedom represent courage, represent how are you going to respond to Carl's corpse? Mm-hmm. Which is, okay, buddy, what restrictions are you imposing on your model that if they do not correspond to the empirical data, you're wrong. Your theory is wrong. Your hypothesis is wrong. The big thing for me is within the regression model, every variable is allowed to relate to every other variable. All the IVs correlate with one another and all the IVs predict the DV. And you perfectly replicate the characteristics of your observed data when you're within the SEM framework because you have no degrees of freedom. What I want to do is walk back up to the whiteboard and to say, I don't think COA, depression, stress, anxiety, negative affect all jointly predict substance use. Instead, I'm going to say this relates to this, this relates to this, this does not relate to that. That's a really important one. We're going to impose restrictions. And if we're staying within the measured variable sphere, that moves us into what some people call a path analysis, or maybe a simultaneous equations. Instead of having one dependent variable, you have multiple dependent variables. So maybe parental alcoholism predicts depression. That's our first dependent variable. But depression, in turn, predicts deviant peer affiliations. Whoa, Mm-hmm. Now we have a system where we have two dependent variables. We now have mediation, we have restrictions, and now we're off to the races because we can arrange those rectangles in any way that we want. We can link them in any way that we want. And Carl quits grumbling over in the corner because now we have degrees of freedom, we have imposed restrictions, and they have become a testable hypothesis.
All of that said, let me ask you this. What if someone has a theory, a complicated theory with multiple dependent variables, but actually their theory is just identified? Their theory is that it's a system where every variable does connect to other things meaningfully. How do you feel about that? How do you handle that from a Popperian standpoint?
That's tricky because you are not imposing testable restrictions onto your model. It is saturated. Some researchers have actually advocated for working with saturated models because of whack-a-mole, that if you impose a restriction and it's incorrect and it introduces a misspecification into the model, it radiates elsewhere. I don't have a strong feeling on saturation versus non-saturation. I guess I would argue for a model that is sufficiently complicated, I'm hard-pressed to see a theory that would call for a saturated model, that every variable is related to every other variable in some way. I might argue, you should probably refine your theory a little bit. It doesn't bother me if there's a saturated model. I mean, you still are getting things like complex tests of mediation. You're still getting things beyond a one dependent variable, multiple regression. But I think you have to look yourself in the mirror and say, I am not testing my hypotheses.
I agree. And let me offer this clarification that whenever you propose a model, whether that model happens to look like a regression model, whether that model is more complex like the one that Patrick described with multiple dependent variables, whenever you propose that, you would like to be able to defend that. And certainly the beginning of your paper will defend it on theoretical grounds. This is why I think this is happening. This is the literature to support it, etc. When you have a just identified model, you will not have statistical grounds to justify that model. You're waiving your right to that because it simply can't exist when everything is in some way connected to everything else. If someone comes to me and says, this is my model, and I look at it and I go, wow, that's a just identified model. Everything is connected to everything else. I don't tell them, you better force something to zero, because that would be me telling them, you better change your theory. But I do tell the person that you can only defend this model on theoretical grounds. You will not get any statistical support for this as a system. So you abdicate that, and then you're not really in model testing. You're more in parameter estimation mode, right? That you're just saying, if this model is correct, we estimate this path to be the following. We estimate this variance to be the following. We estimate this other thing to be that. So you give it up. You can only defend it on theoretical grounds. The same is true in regression. You are not literally testing a regression. You are just saying, if this is the model that characterizes what's going on in the world, then these are the estimates that are associated with that. And so I prefer to have things that are testable, but I won't ever beat somebody's model into some over-identification just so they can get a test of the model.
I would go even a step further in just explicating that if you have a saturated model in the regression, but then even if you move it into a path analytic framework and you don't impose restrictions, you need to understand not only that you're not testing your hypothesis in the way that we talk about inferential tests, you're literally rescaling variances and covariances. You're taking a covariance matrix and you're just putting them in a different metric. Because you're guided by theory, you take that value and imbue it with some kind of importance. But remember, here's a thing at your fingertips, a one predictor regression, X predicting Y, and you get that regression coefficient B1. That is the covariance between X and Y divided by the variance of X. So we make it a one-headed arrow and it becomes predictive. It becomes causal. It becomes downstream. It's an IV and a DV. If X is continuous, flip that around, where now Y predicts X, and you know what your regression coefficient is? It's the covariance between X and Y divided by the variance of Y. all you're doing is rescaling your covariances because they have some kind of meaning for you. That's not bad. You just have to embrace that. You have to realize that and not overstep the bounds of interpretation that somehow you're testing your underlying theory when all you're doing is moving around tables and chairs in the ballroom. It's all the same stuff.
Yeah, exactly right. So you might have a theoretical reason to say it doesn't make sense to use Y as a predictor of X, but there will be no empirical grounds to try to sort that out. And even when you have over-identified models, even when you have these more complex path models, there will be some alternative models that you can't resolve the difference between. Generally speaking, I really like it when people come to the table with multiple competing models, right? Theory has led us to these potential alternatives so that we can estimate those, rule some out, make comparisons among them. There might be some models that the data won't be able to help you resolve. But in regression, you don't even have that. You don't have this ability to compare models other than we put a variable in, we took a variable out, or we put a block of variables in and we took a block of variables out. You're extraordinarily limited in how you can do anything that would even smack of model comparison.
Everything we've talked about up to now has been on measured variables. Gauss-Markov, one of my favorite theorems, exogeneity is one of their assumptions.
Ooh.
I know, right?
Ooh, say it again.
Exogeneity.
Oh, yeah.
Okay, all of that's getting cut out. Exogeneity implies the distribution of the predictor variables in a regression model are fixed and known. There's not a stochastic element. All right, that's cool. We assume a distribution on the residual for the dependent variable y, but the predictors are fixed and known. We're going to load up our parents' minivan and go to Fort Lauderdale. Distributions on your X side, go nuts, man. Distributions on spring break are your X sides. But here's the STD you bring home from Fort Lauderdale. All of those predictors are measured without error. So talk to me about that, Dr. Hancock. I've got this itch I can't quite get rid of.
I have a flood of comments that I'm fighting back.
Attaboy, you don't usually show that degree of self-control.
Okay, so this is the go-to issue for me. This is what I'm really itching to tell you about.
Oh, this stuff writes itself.
When you have a theory, your theory is almost always about constructs. Your theory is almost always about factors, latent variables, call them what you want. Your theory is almost never about the score itself. My theory might be about math achievement. It's not about SAT scores. My theory is about depression. It's not about the Beck depression inventory. And yet we somehow forget that there's this operationalization that occurs between the constructs that we're interested in and the variables that we choose to represent that. And when that is an imperfect connection, we pay in terms of the effect sizes that we want to estimate. We pay in terms of the relations that we're trying to estimate. Let's imagine we have one X variable and one Y variable. I need two constructs here, two latent variables. Give me two from your world.
Perceived stress and anxiety.
So someone has a theory that perceived stress has a causal bearing in anxiety, and they would like to estimate the magnitude of that. So then what happens when we get to the method section? Someone says, we got a measure of perceived stress. We got a measure of anxiety. It's a very reasonable thing to do, but once you make the leap from the construct to the measure, and that measure is not a perfect representation of the constructs that you care about, there's a disconnect. And there might be very little payment for that disconnect if you have really, really good measures. But if you don't have really good measures, and that means if you have lower reliability, then the magnitude of that relation cannot live up to the magnitude that would have otherwise been operating at the construct level. There will be attenuation. There will be dampening. So when you go out into the world and you proclaim the effect of perceived stress on anxiety is 0.4. Well, actually, it might be 0.6, but the measures that you have error built into them. The beauty of the structural equation modeling framework is not just that it can accommodate these networks of variables with multiple independent variables and multiple dependent variables. It's that it can also try to estimate the relations at the latent level so that the estimates that you get of the relations that you are theorizing about, the estimate of the relations among the constructs that you wrote your whole introduction about, those estimates are unbiased. They have been purged of measurement error. And who doesn't want that? Find me someone who doesn't want unbiasedness in the estimates that they get. That, for me, is the big sell for this particular world.
Not only does measurement error on the X side attenuate regression coefficients, what often doesn't get a lot of attention is measurement error in the dependent variable does not have a biasing effect on the regression coefficients, but it biases your standard errors. So if you have measurement error in your variables, your regression coefficients are biased and your standard errors are biased. But other than that, Mrs. Lincoln, did you enjoy the play? When you move to a multiple indicator latent factor, the measurement model itself becomes of theoretical interest. So let's say we have 10 items that are assessing anxiety. Well, are they all equally related to the underlying construct? Are some more salient than others? Do some items measure the underlying construct more effectively for girls than they do for boys? Does the expression of anxious symptomatology change as the child ages? We now have access to all of that we didn't within the manifest variable model. Within the manifest variable model, you've gotten your can of paint from Home Depot, and whatever pigment they put into the paint, isn't that cool? I always love watching them do the paint, as they have just the base paint. And the little computer puts different squirts of paint. They put the lid, shake it up, and hand it to you. That's your manifest variable. You're done. All right? If items are differentially related to your underlying construct, tough crap. If there are racial differences in how the items operate, tough crap. If there's unreliability in the items, tough crap. Here is your can of paint. All the multiple indicator latent factor does is allow you to say, wait. Don't mix those yet. I want those separately. The construct and the measurement model itself becomes of theoretical interest.
I love that analogy. I think it's phenomenal. Imagine you went to Home Depot and they had to put equal squirts of the constituent colors in there. And they go, yeah, we know that's not quite the color you were hoping for, but our machine only does equal squirts of things. You would not go to Home Depot any longer, right? And so the idea that our model, our measurement model, can help to allow variables to be as salient as you need, and they're never literally coming together to form something, but rather they're serving as evidence of these underlying constructs. And variables can indicate differentially when you're dealing with different populations. You don't get that when you just go to Home Depot and say, yeah, squirt some stuff in here.
You can take the analogy that we're playing with one step further and to say you were to go to Home Depot and the guy says, well, I need to put equal squirts in. And you're standing at the counter and say, I don't believe there are equal squirts of pigment. I don't want equal squirts of pigment. But I'm going to use a regression model, so I have to. One of the greatest feelings is when you hit a point at your life and say, oh, have to, do I? And it becomes the control issue again. I don't have to do anything. If I believe there's a multiple indicator latent factor, I can incorporate that into my model in the way that I see fit.
Regression, you're not the boss of me.
Exactly. We're all just going through adolescence.
One of the things that I really like about everything that we have talked about so far is that it's consistent with our goal being estimation of the relations among things, estimation of the magnitudes of things. And when I talk to people sometimes, they say, yeah, whether you do it as measured or latent, it's still going to be significant. That makes me cringe because I don't think of the goal as statistical significance. I think of the goal as being able to accurately estimate relations. This framework for me is about a much more accurate way of estimating the relations that you're theorizing in the first place.
What do you mean accurate?
If there is such a thing as a true effect of perceived stress on anxiety, then my goal isn't just to proclaim that we found a statistically significant impact of it. My goal is to understand the magnitude of that. If, for example, the magnitude of the impact of perceived stress and anxiety is very, very high, and I estimate it accurately, that might warrant particular types of intervention. If I estimate it in an attenuated way, using measures of perceived stress and anxiety that maybe are a bit on the weaker side when it comes to reliability, I might get an estimate of that effect and say, you know, we did detect an effect, although it's fairly small. So maybe that's not something that we would put resources toward intervening in. That's not because it doesn't have the effect. It's because you failed to detect the magnitude of that effect. So I think our goal really ought to be the accurate estimation of the true underlying relations, relations that are not dampened by the quality of the measures that we have in our hand.
We've got path analysis, courage, degrees of freedom. We have multiple indicator latent factors, reliability, making constructs a testable hypothesis in its own right. Tell me a couple of your favorite additional goodies we get with the SEM.
I really, really like this framework for dealing with missing data. I know that in a regression world, you can do multiple imputation and there's great value in doing so. I'm a huge fan of the full information maximum likelihood mechanisms to try to estimate things. Yes, they rely on particular assumptions. Within the structural equation modeling framework, it is extraordinarily elegant. There's no drop wasted here in terms of the information that we can glean.
One of the things that I particularly love, and actually we can extend the Home Depot paint analogy a little bit, is the multiple group framework. We can trick regression into doing moderation, and we can do it quite well. I think there's some very well-established ways of bringing in the interaction between two variables, but it is ultimately a trick. We have one predictor X, a second predictor Z, and to get the interaction in data management, we multiply X and Z together and then bring that in as a predictor. If you ever really think about what we're doing in the regression model, it's weird to bring in this product term and then the unique relation between the product and the outcome is the difference in the relation of one predictor and the outcome as a function of the other. It's elegant. It's beautiful. Mm-hmm. It works like a charm, but it's a trick. In the SEM, we have our paint can that he's squirting the little pigment bits in, and you say, oh, I'm sorry, could I trouble you? Could I please have one of those cans for the treatment group and another can for the control group? Because I can then expand all the goodies of the SEM, mediation, the path analysis, multiple indicator latent factors, and I can do a multiple groups analysis where I test moderation in ways that regression can't even dream about. We can talk about moderating an entire mediated effect as a function of treatment versus control. We can look at measurement invariance. It's mind-numbingly powerful.
One of the things that I've heard people say is that the measured variable world, the regression world, is just so much easier to deal with moderation because you just form some product terms. And in the latent variable world, it's awkward, cumbersome, challenging to estimate, etc. There is some truth that in the latent variable world, moderation can be challenging. But what I would counter with is that if you would rather multiply two crappy measures together and say that that's going to give you a good sense of moderation, then do something that's a little bit more cumbersome, but that actually has a prayer, as in power, as in the ability to properly estimate the magnitude of the actual moderation going on. I would choose the hard thing. I want to estimate the magnitude of things in an accurate kind of way. The structural modeling framework, it's so much more versatile to get at these moderations, these mediated moderations. I love that.
And it's like saying, oh, it's so much harder to fly a 737-800 than it was a DC-3. It's just way easier to fly a DC-3. And it's like, yeah, those engines fell off. Like people got sucked out of windows. They froze to death. Suck it up and do the harder thing because that's what is best.
In the end, for me, this is not about fancy for fancy's sake. And I know that sometimes reviewers will tell authors to redo something with another analytical framework that does the same damn thing. I am in no way in favor of that. When the tool that you have directly addresses your question, does all the things you want, there's no need to do something fancier. But I don't embrace structural equation modeling because it's fancier. I embrace structural equation modeling because there is much less of a seam between what you theorize and the way that you analyze the data. For me, what you want to have is that the introduction telegraphs the way that you're going to analyze the data, and the way that you analyze the data informs the conclusions that you want to reach that tie back to the questions that you addressed initially. Being able to build the model that you want that ties directly to the theories that you have, both in terms of complexity about all the variables that you have, but also in terms of trying to do things at the construct level where most of your theories are, that to me is the huge selling point. Again, not fancy for fancy's sake, but fancy because it addresses the things that you actually want to address.
Let's not forget that our high school friend is a good guy, and he's a really good guy. And I often get a question from somebody who says, all right, I've had ANOVA and regression. I took factor analysis, SEM, multi-level modeling, and longitudinal SEM. What should I take next? And my sincere response is, take another regression course. Mm-hmm. Go over to Biostats, take a matrix-based regression course. Because in spite of everything that we just said, regression is the cornerstone for almost everything that we do. To have an unambiguously clear concept of what is a partial parameter, what is a residual variance, what is an R-squared, a factor loading in a CFA is a regression coefficient. It is the regression of an item on a latent variable. Mm-hmm. If you do a factor analysis in SAS and you do an oblique rotation and you try to find among the 83 matrices that you're trying to interpret, the one that you want is labeled rotated factor pattern paren standardized regression coefficients. So don't forget that your high school friend is a good guy and he took you far, and that we are in no way saying that we're done with regression and we're moving forward. For you quanti folks who are looking for how do I solidify my understanding, my strong recommendation is take another regression class. The broader arc is know what that regression model is doing, what the limitations are, and that you may not be testing your theory in the way that you think you are or in the way that you want to, and you need to move to the SEM to do both of those things.
And we really strongly encourage people to join us. Come have some Kool-Aid. We've got tons of it. And for those people who haven't taken all of the advanced stuff and are taking regression to maybe offer themselves a bit more rounded perspective on how things fit together, there are the other folks who have made it up to regression and are wondering if that's enough. And I would say, I really think it's not enough. We want you to come over and have some Kool-Aid with us. Not just because we're lonely and have no friends, that's part of it.
That's
right?
A big part.
It's a huge part. But because we think it will open the way that you think about your research questions, it will help give you a lot more flexibility to address things. And that, at the end of the day, I think is what our research needs.
On that point, I'm done. Thank you, everyone.
All right. See you. Thanks. Hey, couponers. Don't forget to tell your friends to check us out on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever they go to avoid doing their day jobs. You can also follow us on Twitter, where we are at QuantitudePod, and visit our website, quantitudepod.org, where you can leave us a message and listen to past episodes. And finally, you can get rockin' Quantitude merch on redbubble.com, where all proceeds go to donorschoose.org to help support remote access in low-income schools. You've been listening to Quantitude, the podcast that does not think those pants make your butt look big at all. Today's episode is brought to you by the number of iterations. Go ahead, increase it. That'll totally solve your problem. And by the colon, time-honored punctuation of bloated and self-aware academic paper titles everywhere. And finally, by a probit procedure. Coincidentally, the technique endorsed by both statisticians and proctologists. This is most definitely not NPR.